Yo.
Episode 99.
What a fine day to cry.
All right, sure.
99 problems, and this podcast is one of them. Just kidding. I make that joke later, and I just made it again because I thought it was good. It's not good. We're ethically ambiguous. This is episode 99.
Are you having a stroke? Today I'm going to talk a little bit about Iran and the nuclear situation and some comments they made at a press conference with the Japanese Prime Minister Abe Shinzo? Shinzo Abe. Whoa.
Yeah.
Just lost my mind again. We're all having strokes.
And I'm going to be talking about a Syrian revolutionary that unfortunately died last week, Al-Sarut. And I'm also going to be dedicating a lot of this episode to the atrocities that are happening in Sudan. So please stay tuned. It's very important. And don't go anywhere.
Who are we? Where did we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pants? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Hello. Hi. How are you? Shireen?
I'm sorry. I'm chugging a Diet Coke.
This is another episode. Oh my god, this is episode 99? I believe it's episode 90-fucking-9 of Ethnically Ambiguous. That's a lot. That's a big fucking number. Got 99 problems. This episode is one of them.
What?
Okay. Sorry for your loss, Anna. Your grandfather died.
Oh yes, my grandpa died. Last week, I guess technically.
Yeah.
He was older. I had a sense it was going well. When I spoke to him on like Iranian New Year-ish, I had a feeling around that time, March, I had a feeling I may not see him again, because that's kind of the thing when your family lives in a different country that's very far away and hard to get to.
Yeah.
You just kind of come to terms with the fact that you will lose family members and not be able to say goodbye or really anticipate anything because you can't see them.
Yeah.
So what can you do except for just kind of deal with the situation? And, you know, I'll probably go to Iran for like a week. I don't know when, probably on his 40th day. Because in Iran, after you celebrate 40 days after the death, because that's when the soul officially leaves the body.
Yeah. It's a beautiful tradition.
Yeah, so I might, head to Iran for that with my mom, because it's my mom's dad. Should be an interesting trip. Hopefully nothing goes wrong.
No, it won't. It won't.
There's a lot going on with Iran and the U.S. right now, so it will definitely be a tumultuous situation with the Americas.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going to happen. It'll be nice to see my family. I really want to see my grandma because she's getting old, too, and
it's really hard when your family lives so far away, because it's true. Like, you don't know when, if that's the last time you're going to see them. I feel that way all the time with my family.
Yeah. I felt bad for my mom because she's like, I spoke to him this Sunday and he seemed fine.
Aww.
I was like, that's how it goes, dude. They always seem fine until
they don't.
They die in their sleep. And you're like, God damn it.
At least it was a peaceful way to go.
Yeah.
Twas
peaceful.
Well, I've already started and I'm sad.
That's how it goes.
Less than 3 minutes.
Old people die.
Something
we just have to get used to.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a nice man, it was funny. He would try and give us money, and we'd be like, your money isn't worth anything.
The thought that counts, Anna.
Iranian money is useless, thanks to the U.S. But I'll take any of his money, honestly.
Anna, too soon.
I'm just joking. There was no way he left me any money. He's probably like, yeah, they don't want this money.
Well, he has, like, probably, like, 50 grandchildren, so.
He has a lot, baby.
Yep. That's how it goes in the Middle Eastern household.
My mom was his oldest kid, and, she left Iran. They had a complicated relationship. You know, he was always a ladies' man, and he was a very hard man, Muslim. He did the best he could, you know. He's a tough Iranian man, as they tend to be. And I'm sure, you know, so my grandma and my grandpa only had one kid together, and it was my mom.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was situations where after my grandma and grandpa got divorced, he married my grandma's sister. So some of my mom's cousins were her half-sisters, because that's how it goes in Iran sometimes.
Best player.
Yeah, and then for a while he had two wives, because that's the Iranian way. Sometimes you have multiple wives and multiple kids. And, you know, from there he ditched a wife. And he's still with one of the wives that he, or was with one of the wives when he passed. So he had a long life. He had, like, a lot of kids. You know, my mom helped raise them all. So they all have this, like, they have this, like, they all tell me how indebted they are to my mom.
The same
for
thing with my mom.
Them.
My mom was the oldest daughter. She was the third out of nine, and the only the daughter.
Oldest daughter. Oh yeah.
So yeah.
And the women, you know, the women always do everything because that's the way it goes. Women do everything always.
Always. So many of my uncles are just like, your mom raised me.
Yeah.
So yeah, totally.
It's nice though. I talk to a lot of my cousins and family members, and
it's good.
I mean, I talk to them often on, like, Instagram and stuff, but, like, it was nice to reconnect and be like, damn, doggy, that's sad.
Mm-hmm.
Poor Gramps.
Poor Gramps.
Which is my favorite thing about him. He didn't have any, like, framed photos of any of the grandchildren, but he had two framed photos of my cats.
That's amazing.
Like, he's like, yeah, I asked your mom to send them to me, and then I framed them. This was, like,
that's adorable.
2 years ago when I was there, and he was telling me about it. He's like, yeah, you know. And it was funny, because I came in, and he was immediately like, come look at the framed photos of the cats. And I was like, oh, my God, you framed the cats? He's like, yeah, I asked your mom to send me pictures of your cats, because I know how much you like them.
Aw, that's
It's too
so
bad I couldn't
nice.
Send him a picture of Ace to frame.
Oh.
But it's a really funny photo, too. The cats just casually happen to be sitting next to each other.
Uh-huh.
And this is basically my cat and then my parents' cat, who used to be my cat. So they're, like, sitting next to each other at my parents' house. And my mom sent him the photo.
That's adorable. I love that.
And he framed them. And then there's, like, literally a framed picture of the cats and a framed picture of my mom from college. And then, like, that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think there's a framed picture of me and my brother. And then, like, all my other cousins. Like, funny how he, like, doesn't have any photos of us. And we're like,
but of your pets.
Yeah. He's like, look at this. My really funny younger cousin. He's so hilarious. Muhammad Reza, he's always like, isn't this crazy? Like, look, there's a photo of me, like, all the way in the corner, like, hidden, and you're, like, all up
Dude,
in the display case. And
that's
I was
how
like,
I felt
yeah,
growing
well.
Up. Yeah.
I was like, he sees you every goddamn day. Stop complaining.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. R.I.P.
Shout out to...
Yeah.
You know what's a funny thing? I never knew what my grandpa's first name was.
Whoa.
I just never knew. Because you don't ever call them by their first name.
Yeah.
And I always go, Baba. So that's my Baba, and his name was his last name is Babak, so I'd always call him Baba Babak because I thought it was funny.
Great fucking name.
And you just don't say like, and then you know, in like just Persian culture, you call them like Haji.
Mm-hmm. And Jindo for us, we call
yeah. So I
or Haji,
you know,
come on,
you know, like Haji Baba Babak, and like, so I like asked my dad and my mom. I was like, wait. What is his name? And they were like, what? And I was like, well, I only ever called him Baba. I've never in my life had to call him by his first name. Also, it'd be like inappropriate for me to refer to him as his first name. And then I also just like, I don't refer to him in any formal setting where I'm like, please, please meet my grandfather's, you know, whatever. And his first name is Sederla.
That's beautiful.
Which I did not know. Haji Sederla Babak, which it's crazy.
Yeah.
Like, I kind of knew my grandma. My grandma's name is Nagus, and I have a cousin, Nagus. But, I don't know, it was just nutty.
Yeah,
like, to ask that, to be like, wait, what?
Yeah, because in Arabic culture, we also say, we say Haji or Haje for a woman, and then we say, like, Tete and Jindo is grandma and grandpa. But I think the only reason I know my grandparents' names so well is because they lived with my mom and I for, with my parents and I for a while. So, like, all their insurance and health bills would come in, like, Khalid Mahdi or
okay,
maybe.
That makes more sense, because I never... I just, you just don't.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny because I know my dad's parents' names, but they died way before I was born.
Right.
Like when my dad was young. So there was like things that were memorialized in them because my dad's mom's name is Tavus, which means peacock. So there was a ton of peacock
Tavus
imagery.
Means in Arabic too, Tavus.
Nice. Tavus. Yeah, yeah. So there's a ton of imagery in our home growing up that were a bunch of peacocks.
Ah.
And so like I always knew that was because of my dad's mother.
Yeah.
And then my dad's father's name is Reza because my brother's named after him. So like
also,
I
like
knew
50%
that.
Of Persian men
yes,
are called
Reza.
Yeah.
So like I already knew that my brother was named after my grandpa. So I always knew their names because it was actively shown to me, and then there was no reason for me to refer to them as grandma and grandpa because I never got the chance to interact with them.
Yeah.
But the ones I interact with, I would never call them by their first name. So it was a very surreal thing where I was like, holy shit, I don't even know my grandpa's first name
because
it's so uncommon for me to ever interact with him in that way.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's just Baba.
Just Baba. Virgin Dofer for us. Baba is like my dad.
Yeah, so...
What do you call your dad?
I call my dad Dad.
Oh, okay. Word.
Because the thing is, I always called my grandpa Baba because my mom called him Baba and I wanted to be like my mom. So my mom would be like, oh, Baba's calling. So I'd be like, Baba. So I never called him Baba Bozog, which means like grandpa, because... actually, Baba Bozog really translates to big dad.
Whoa.
Bozog is like big.
Yeah.
So I would never call... like, I just never called
big
him
dad.
Baba Bozog or big daddy because my mom said Baba. So I was like, yeah, that's Baba.
Right.
So I never called my dad Baba.
Yeah.
Because I was like, Baba is my grandpa.
Right. That's
so I don't know. It was just like how I was as a kid. Yeah. I just was like, well, mommy calls him Baba, so I call him Baba.
And now you look just like your mom.
I know.
You're
like
wearing a shawl.
I'm wearing a shawl. I'm wearing my sandals.
Yeah.
I'm wearing sandals that my mom literally wears every day. She only She only wears these kind of sandals. And they're
really
incredibly
comfy.
Comfortable.
Yeah.
Hey, she ain't wrong. You know?
She ain't wrong. I did watch Kiarostami's was a really phenomenal Iranian filmmaker, and I watched one of his films for the first time. I've watched his films before. Close Up is like one of my favorite films of all time. But this other film Taste of Cherry, I watched last week, and obviously I watched it with subtitles because I don't speak Farsi. But there are so many words that are so similar to Arabic. Like
that's when I watch things in Arabic.
Yeah,
I'm like, wow, that's basically
like
when I watched Rami, I was like, yeah, God, that's all like it's so similar.
It's so similar. Like, and I feel like it would be so. I really want to learn it now because I feel like I'm already like a third of the way there.
Right, which I think that's why it was easier potentially when my mom was growing up to learn Arabic to do her prayers in.
Yeah,
because it's like
there are so many words that are similar. There's a little. I think you guys have some more like extra syllables here and there. It's more sing-songy.
Sing-songy.
But it's really interesting. What do you want to talk about today?
Well, you know, today I was going to talk a little bit about Iran.
Should we get into it?
Yeah, let's get into it.
Cool.
Which makes me nervous because if I have to go to Iran soon, so
you'll be okay.
I'm going to talk a little bit about this thing that happened. Basically last week for you guys, which was this morning for us, there was attack on oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman near Iran. Sorry, just burping. And basically the Trump administration and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, they blame Iran for it. And Mike Pompeo went on to say, Iran is lashing out because the regime wants our successful maximum pressure campaign lifted. No economic sanctions entitle the Islamic Republic to attack innocent civilians, disrupt oil markets, and engage in nuclear blackmail. Now, I do want to say, I don't think there's any proof as of now that Iran attacked them.
Mm-hmm.
It's unclear. I don't know where the blame potentially just comes from the fact that there's already tensions. It did happen in the Strait of Hormuz, which is basically run by, it's like Iran's like a vital like shipping route, whatever. So they also blamed that May 12th attack on the four tankers in the same area on Tehran, Iran. Yeah, but I don't know. I don't know if the Trump administration just needs them to blame or, it could potentially have been the Houthi rebels attacking, which, you know, there's been claims that Iran gives the Houthi rebels weapons. So, they're given weapons because the Houthi rebels are out here in like fucking Yemen fighting Saudi Arabia. But that's a whole other story, which we've kind of gone into in the past. I don't even remember anymore.
I think we have.
What we've spoken about on this show.
It's been 99 episodes,
yeah,
y'all.
It's unclear. I do think it's very rash of the fucking Trump administration to jump out here and be like, yeah, well, Iran's doing it. And it's like, we don't know shit right now. Everyone in the Middle East hates the U.S. for the most part. So chill the fuck out. If it was the Houthi rebels, they're fucking with you for a reason. So I kind of want to touch on that. But I also wanted to talk about Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. He met with the Iran Supreme Leader Khamenei about basically to ease tensions between the U.S. and Iran. And so Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei he basically assured Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe that Iran has no intention to make, hold, or use nuclear weapons, but at the same time saying that the country will not negotiate with the United States. Basically, they have already come out. Foreign Minister Javad Zarif came out and said that the U.S. will not negotiate, or not, Iran will not negotiate with the U.S. under any circumstances while Trump is in office. They just have no interest. They're like, we don't want to fuck with this who's trash.
Yeah.
So Abe met with Khamenei, who is, to make, if you guys don't know, the Iran's supreme leader. He is the top decision maker. He's the guy, you know, like there's a president, Rouhani, but Rouhani does have to consult with Khamenei
like the final go ahead.
Yeah, like he can't just be like, this is what I think and this is what's going to happen. It's like, no, there's a supreme leader that he also has to consult with. So, yeah, so Abe, he met with the supreme leader on Thursday last week during a trip to Iran in an attempt to ease the tensions between Iran and the U.S. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani was at the meeting. And afterward, Abe told reporters that Khamenei had told him that Iran will not make or have nuclear weapons, and it has no intentions of, you know, going after anyone with nuclear weapons. And shortly after, Iranian state news agency Fars confirmed the comment, but added that Khamenei had said that Iran basically did not consider Donald Trump worthy of a message from Tehran. The quote says, I do not see Trump as worthy of any message exchange, and I do not have any reply for him or now in the future. The Supreme Leader also reportedly said that he does not believe Trump's offer of honest negotiations, that he thinks the U.S. president's promise not to seek regime change in Iran is a lie. The comments kind of came as a blow to Abe, who told reporters at a joint press conference with Rouhani on Wednesday that helping to ease tensions in the region was the one single thought that brought me to Iran. Abe was in Iran for about 2 days, and he became the first sitting Japanese prime minister to visit the country since its 1979 Islamic Revolution.
Wow.
Which is interesting. I'm glad he kind of went in there to try and be a go-between. We'll see how well that works out. So, yeah, I mean, ever since the nuclear deal, Trump basically reimposed crippling sanctions on Iran, and he's deployed troops to troops and aircraft carriers to the Gulf. And in response, the Iranian Foreign Prime Minister Javad Zarif, he warned on Monday that the U.S. could not expect to stay safe while imposing an economic war on Iran, and said that Iran would not engage in any talks unless the U.S. was prepared to make concessions, which obviously the U.S. has no interest in doing. Mm-hmm. And to give a little background, Japan is a key U.S. ally in the Asia-Pacific region, and Abe appears to have a good relationship with Trump, who has said the pair have very, very good chemistry.
Fucking A.
Who knows how Abe really feels. Well, so, excuse me. Japanese Chief Cabinet Secretary Yoshihide Suga, he said that the pair being Abe and Trump, had spoken about Iran by telephone on Tuesday. And Japan has had traditionally good ties with Iran, having once been a substantial buyer of Iranian oil until it was forced by U.S. sanctions to halt purchases. So at that press conference, Rouhani said that he saw Japanese interest in continuing to buy oil as a guarantee for the ongoing development of bilateral ties. And the Takashi Oshuga, who's a spokesperson for Japan's foreign ministry, said that deciding on oil purchases was the domain of private companies, so they weren't going to publicly comment on whether or not they will be buying oil from them anymore. So, I mean, as the first leader of the G7 country to visit the Islamic Republic, and that's Abe, since Trump's withdrawal from the nuclear deal, he is the most high-profile representative of recent diplomatic efforts to engage Iran amongst, you know, the rising tensions with the U.S. So also Minister Heiko Maas, who is the German foreign minister, he held talks on saving the nuclear deal in the Iranian capital Tehran on Monday. And European foreign policy official, Helga Maria Schmid. Sorry, there's a bunch of names that I cannot pronounce well. Also, European Union's foreign policy official, Helga Marie Schmid, is also due to travel to Iran this week to help basically save the nuclear deal.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like the visits are, you know, they're a good indicator of the extent of the international concern over tensions that have been escalating in the Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, you know, as I was speaking of earlier, the two tankers in the Gulf of Oman were attacked and they've both been evacuated. One of the vessels was operated by a Japanese shipping company. And also on Thursday last week, Saudi Arabia warned of grave consequences for Iran after a missile attack by Iranian-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen hit a Saudi airport and wounded 26 people a day earlier. Which is like, oh, I'm sorry, Saudi Arabia, you fucking care about mm-hmm. people's lives now? You've literally murdered so many people in Yemen and also created quite the goddamn... when people are starving. Famine. So, fuck you, Saudi Arabia, for even being upset that 26 people were killed when you haven't given a shit about any other goddamn innocent life in that country of Yemen since you decided to destroy it little by little with airstrikes and every other fucking coalition shit you're up to. Anyway, so... At that press conference with Rouhani on Wednesday last week, Abe said that it was essential that Iran plays a constructive role in the building solid peace and stability in the Middle East, noting that conflict might be triggered accidentally. So I think that's a good point of, like, it's too much shit for, like, the U.S. pushing on them and then, like, Saudi Arabia pushing on them. And then, it's so convoluted that, like, you don't want this to explode. Like, it's mm-hmm. like you have to be so careful with these tensions because, like, you're out here saying this and you're out here saying that, and all of a sudden Iran's being like, well, why'd you say this? Why'd you say that? Why are you blaming us? You can't, these buttons are not the ones to push. It's like, it's too dangerous. It makes me, like, really confused about what's gonna happen because who are, like, why? Why do you want to fuck with Iran so badly? Mm-hmm. Like, let it be. Get the nuclear deal. Like, what you need to do is secure that nuclear deal. Why do you even want to give Iran a reason to decide that they all of a sudden want to make nuclear weapons? Which, of course, they said they have no intention to, but still.
But you're pushing them.
You're just being assholes and hoping these people give in to you, which is not going to happen. It's not how it works. It doesn't work like that. Nobody, like, wants to deal with this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't, it's insane to me. And then you're, like, out here, like, don't blame Iran until you have 100% proof Iran did that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's crazy to me. I don't know. I hate the Trump administration's a bunch of idiots that just want to blame their quote unquote terrorist country because they have nothing else going on and they refuse to take
a scapegoat.
Yeah, they don't make any acknowledgement of their own behavior in this situation. Like, one, you went out of your way to get out of that nuclear deal and then at the exact same time are being like, oh, we should get in this nuclear deal, but you just need to call me and I'll set up a nuclear. It's like, it doesn't work like that. You've proven yourself to be a fucking idiot and now the country doesn't want to deal with you. Like, mm-hmm. what do you think is going to happen?
Yeah.
Anyway, so on that note, let's take a quick commercial break. And we're back. Just got news, Sarah Huckabee Sanders is resigning, I guess.
We're back, yeah.
Because she's going to run for governor
the whole
of Arkansas?
The whole fucking Trump administration are incompetent. I saw this video the other day of Trump. Apparently, like, Biden called him old, and there's a video of this Trump. I hate talking about him on this podcast, but there's a video of Trump being like, I'm a young and vibrant man. And it's just a joke. This just made me look it up. I'm not going to post it because I don't want to give him any attention, but look it up. It's very funny. Yeah.
What's young and vibrant about him?
Nothing. Should I?
Yeah.
So the majority of my stuff today is about Sudan and the atrocities that are happening over there. If you guys haven't heard, please stay tuned because there's a lot to get into and it's really awful. But I would be remiss if I did not talk about this a person that died in Syria. I was visiting my parents on Sunday, and my mom found out this person had died, and she was literally in tears. He was a revolutionary that really was the was symbolic of the revolution in Syria, and his name was Abdelbaset el-Sarut. Everyone called him Sarut, and he was the controversial figurehead of the Syrian rebellion. He was a goalkeeper who became a rebel icon and, quote, the singer of the revolution, and he died from wounds from a Hama battle at age 27 a couple days ago, so last week. When for his funeral, the Aisha Mosque in Idlib's El-Dana town on Sunday of last week, they were singing the words of his songs, and as I said, he was a Syrian footballer turned revolutionary, and he became a revolutionary songwriter and a rebel. People were bidding farewell to him, civilians and militia alike. He was wrapped in white, as you often are in the Middle East when you die, and his body was carried out of the mosque on the shoulders of his fans. And people were trying to touch his lifeless face, and others were trying to, like, just help. They're holding their arms up to take photographs with his body. He died of wounds after fighting against the Syrian government army in Tel Mele, a town that the government of Hama, a town in the government of Hama that is part of the war's last rebel held enclave. Home to 3 million people, the final bastion of rebel forces has come under attack over the last month by the government and its ally Russia. Hundreds of people, fighters and civilians, have been killed. Hadi Abdullah, he's a prominent anti-Syrian government activist and one of Sarut's closest friends. He told Al Jazeera that El Sarut was wounded while trying to rescue his fellow fighters. He said that's when an artillery shell hit him. He suffered an injury and an already wounded leg, and that eventually killed him. So I just want to give some background on him before getting into Sudan, because seeing my mom so affected by his death was really heartbreaking for me, because I really saw how much he was symbolic of the struggle of the rebels over there. And he truly grew up in the revolution. Like, he died at 27, so he was in his early 20s, teenage years, when this all started. So basically, he had abandoned his football dreams, or soccer dreams, and he joined the rebellion against President Bashar al-Assad back in 2011. And in the years that followed, he was known as, quote, the singer of the revolution because of his odes to the uprising. At his funeral, his supporters recited one of his most famous slogans that translates into heaven, 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 our homeland, your heaven, big-hearted homeland, even your hell is heaven. And this was basically an anthem for a lot of anti-Assad Syrians. In the eight-year Syrian war, few embodied the divide within the country as profoundly as this young man, because he spent his childhood between all of this. And when he was a child, he was in school and he went to football practice. And one of his childhood friends told Al Jazeera that his father constantly admonished him for playing football. And he was actually, his father banned him from going to any of the matches. But he would escape and go anyway. And when he was a teenager, Sarut's father insisted he work alongside him in the construction sector, but he refused and kept on playing football. And again, Abdullah, who was a close friend to El-Sarut's family, said the singer's world turned upside down when the Assad government crushed the peaceful protest he helped lead in 2011. Drawing from his local popularity, El-Sarut himself then started forming a local militia. He was among the first to defend his family's neighborhood called El-Badaya, and he formed a battalion called the El-Badaya Martyrs, and four of his brothers were fighting with him in the same battalion, and all four of those brothers and many of Sarut's friends died in the war. In 2014, he was forced to move out of Homs as government forces retook control. And there's some controversy surrounding him because after he lost a lot of loved ones and just suffered a lot of loss at the hands of the Syrian government and its allies, people say that his attitudes toward hardline groups like ISIL or Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS, or even the Al-Qaeda affiliate Jabhat al-Nusra, They say that his attitudes toward these groups softened, but he was adamant that he never joined them. It was just, I think that's why if you talk to Syrians, some people, like most people love him, but some people that are with the government obviously don't. Early in the uprising, he appeared alongside actress Fawda Salaman, who's a well-known actress of Alawi descent. Alawi is the same sect and ethnic group as Bashar al-Assad. And they were preaching coexistence together, but right before he evacuated from Homs in a video message, he sees them. He was seen in a video with ISIL members saying that they wanted to fight soldier to soldier to defeat Bashar al-Assad. So I think, like, in times of desperateness, he would do anything. And I don't take that. I mean, like, he was so adamant in every documentary. It's a really beautiful documentary online that I'll try to find and talk at length in a different episode, but he was always seen as someone with not much of an ideology, but reflected the atmosphere in which he grew up and the one that surrounded him during the war. And in that situation, and I feel like that's why it was so controversial, because he just went with whatever he thought would overtake the Syrian government. And he came from exactly the type of background that became the foundation for the Syrians' armed rebellion, which is basically just a rural Sunni Bedouin family that had migrated from the tribal hinterlands into congested neighborhoods in Homs, trying to make ends meet in an economy that was stacked against them. And he dedicated the rest of his life to fighting the war in what became his hometown of Homs, just as much as it is about Hama, or about Syria, Assad, politics, or Islam. So the uprising, as it went to hell, he ended up drifting around a lot because the world was shaped by extremism and warlordism around him. But I feel like his life and his choices just kind of like shine a light to the ideological divisions within the opposition itself, because so many groups joined in when no one else did. But in 2017, he was seized by HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which is a extremist group, on a charge of pledging allegiance to ISIL. So one group said that he was allegiant to another one, and he denied the charge and instead, to save his life, became a commander with this faction. And it was while fighting with this group that he was killed. So like many other rebel fighters, groups, and their supporters, al-Assad called for cooperation between opposition groups against al-Assad. That was his whole goal, even if temporarily, because he wanted them to become a cohesive force against the government and halt its advances. Nicholas Haras, who is a Middle East Secretary Fellow at the Center of the New American Security, said that al-Sadr represented the failure of the Syrian revolutionary movement to provide a vision of how to turn a widely supported protest movement into an inclusive force for a post-conflict state. So basically, al-Sadr, he left a mixed legacy among his Syrian fans, but the majority of Syrians are mourning his death and what they feel like is the end of the revolution. And that's how my mom felt too. So I just needed to talk about him a little bit, just because seeing my mom so affected, and this war massacre has been going on in Syria for so long, to have this figurehead that has been there for a long time go down this way. And he's been wounded before, and he always bounces back, or he always had in the past, and this is final, and he was only 27, and he just represented hope. And I think his death really feels like the end of any real chance against Bashar, which is really sad. And I want to talk about him more in the future, because there's a really good documentary about him. But for now, because he died last week, I wanted to talk about him. And now, are you ready to talk about Sudan?
Yeah.
It's even worse. Okay, if you haven't heard, it's probably because a lot of media outlets are not talking about it. But basically, protesters are being killed in Sudan because these protesters are calling for civilian rule. And today's news cycle seems largely centered on the fact that the U.S. is sending Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Tibor P. Nagy, They're sending them to meet with the leaders of Sudan. But the vast majority of Western media are not talking about the fact that at least 118 people were killed by government-backed military forces in Sudan after they descended upon a peaceful sit-in protest earlier this month. So a little bit of background. Omar al-Bashir was ousted in April in Sudan. He was the leader of Sudan nearly 30 years after he came into power via military coup during a north and south civil war of the country. An eventual international criminal court against him for genocide and other crimes against humanity was effectively put on hold amid a lack of support from the UN. But still, despite that, April was a time of hope in Sudan, because after nearly 30 years in power, this dictator, al-Bashir, was ousted by the country's military, and before that, it was culminating in months of mass protests. And images of demonstrations were shared internationally, including one striking photo of a young woman standing atop of a car. She had like this white robe, and it was a callback to clothing worn by women in the 60s, 70s, and 80s when they marched against military dictatorships. And on the streets of the capital, Khartoum, were thousands of protesters. And in the wake of al-Bashir's rule, defined by brute military force and open genocide, pro-democracy activists hoped for a return to civilian-led government. And following his removal, protesters continued their work toward ensuring a military-ruled government wasn't put into place, because if it was, it would just lead to a repeat of what inspired this uprising in the first place. Additionally, activists say that many of these military groups were close to Omar al-Bashir and or shared his ideology. So even after his removal, other military groups tried to join, basically, or like take power, and protesters were, they didn't stop their protesting. They were trying to change the path of the government. Instead, the military commanders who forced al-Bashir to step down have remained in power, and talks between democratic activists and military leaders to transition the government to civilian rule have stalled out, as generals now say they won't hold elections for another 9 months. CBS News reported that there is a growing fear among the Sudanese people that whatever elections the military hold will neither be free or fair, and that it would be, quote, orchestrated simply to legitimize the appointment of a new military dictator.
It's weird that that happens.
Yeah, every fucking country, every Middle Eastern country, a fucking military coup after military coup after military coup. It happened in Syria, it's happening here, it happened in Egypt. So last week, which is 2 weeks ago for you guys, because we're recording this on the week, we're on June 13th. So the military orchestrated a violent crackdown in Khartoum, the capital, with paramilitary troops killing and sexually assaulting scores of peaceful protesters, particularly at a protest camp in the capital. A medical official working with a protest with a pro-reform group of doctors told The Guardian that hospitals in the capital had an estimated, quote, more of 70 cases of rape during the attack and its aftermath, which also saw more than 100 deaths and at least 700 injuries. In Darfur, where al-Bashir's troops committed horrific acts of atrocities against Darfuri men, women, and children for years, war crimes were still happening with impunity. This is what Amnesty International reported. They say that they have witnessed in the past 3 days horrific and barbaric things. The senseless killing of protesters must be stopped immediately, and those responsible for the bloodbath, including at command level, must be held fully accountable for their dreadful actions. The Transitional Military Council and the opposition groups have agreed to resume talks regarding who should head this government ahead, or this transitional government, and the eventual elections that were going to take place. And amid the violence, many have rightfully criticized the lack of mainstream media attention given to reform efforts in Sudan. There was one news site, Sky News, that was heavily criticized because, like, hours after this massacre happened, they posted about Kim Kardashian's fucking baby. And they got dragged, deservingly, on social media. But pushes for awareness are coming from other celebrities that are far better, like Rihanna, for example, and others, and they have inspired praise. I want to talk about this. George Clooney has also expressed public support for protesters and others affected by the violence. And I want to especially note what a good ally George Clooney is, because in March 2012, he was actually arrested at the Sudan embassy in Washington during a protest because he said, quote, "We are here to ask two very simple questions," he said during a protest. "The first question is something immediate, and immediately we need humanitarian aid to be allowed into Sudan before it becomes the worst humanitarian crisis in the world." Again, this is in 2012. He fucking called it. Like, he saw something bad coming, as did most Sudanese people. And he continued to say, "The second thing is for the government in Khartoum to stop randomly killing its own innocent men, women, and children. Stop raping them and stop starving them. That's all we ask." Again, that was said in March 2012, which is fucking wild when you think about it. At the time, he testified against the violence at the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee, and he claimed that the violence in Sudan is being led by, who you guessed it, the president at the time, Omar al-Bashir, and government officials Ahmed Haroun and Defense Minister Abdulrahim Mohamed Hussein. The fact that this has been going on for years, nearly a decade, is so concerning. And now it's just at the apex, and it's like bubbling over, and still media outlets are not covering it as much as they should. It's disgusting what's been going on in this country at the hands of its own government. We're gonna take our last commercial break, and I'll be right back just to break down what's happening in Sudan and what you can do about it. So we'll be right back. And we're back. So, last week, earlier this month, during the massacre, there was a media blackout and internet censorship happened for four consecutive days.
You know what was interesting was this article that Jack told me about, mm-hmm. that how, like, media blackouts by governments don't necessarily help. I don't know. It's interesting.
No, they don't help at all.
Check it out.
They don't help at all because
think
it makes
like
it
they
worse.
They can't spread any information so people can't.
Look what happened in Chernobyl.
Yeah.
That was like that was decades ago, but it's HBO's. It happened last week. So in Sudan, there was a huge media blackout, internet censorship for four consecutive days. There was no objective media sharing on what was going on except for Al Jazeera English, but their offices had been shot down. So let's just cover what we know about the crisis in Sudan so far. Doctors in Khartoum counted 118 people dead as a result of the military crackdown in the capital on last Monday, according to the New York Times. 40 bodies were pulled from the Nile, and doctors have been reporting more than 70 cases of rape during the attack. The government has admitted to only 61 deaths and hasn't even bothered to address the accusations of rape. The World Health Organization reported that at least 784 people in Khartoum have been wounded in the last week as a result of military confrontations. On Sunday of last week, pro-democracy protesters in Khartoum brought the city to a standstill during a general strike. Sunday is the first day of the work week in Sudan. Multiple outlets report businesses throughout the capital were shuttered and the streets were empty and desolate. According to the Times, security forces killed three protesters during the strike. Again, these protesters are not armed. NPR reported that members of the military have rounded up, quote, essential employees at gunpoint to force them back to work. Pro-democracy activists have gone underground as they figure out their next steps. The driving force of the violence is the, quote, Rapid Support Forces, the RSF, led by General Mohamed Hamdan, who is more commonly known as Hameti. The paramilitary faction of the Sudanese military, the RSF, has been accused of working alongside the Janjaweed militia under al-Bashir's rule, burning villages in Darfur, and systematically killing and raping innocent Darfuris in the early 2000s. This is, I'm assuming, what got George Clooney's attention and why he got arrested in 2012.
It's weird how little we can trust our own government or our own militaries.
It's disgusting. It's so horrid. They're supposed to be protecting us, and they are the devil incarnate. In recent years, so that happened in Darfur. If you don't know what happened in Darfur, I'm sure at least you recognize the name Darfur because huge atrocities happened there in the early 2000s, where, again, massacres were happening, rapes were happening by the hands of the government. In recent years, they've been accused of continuing chemical attacks and widespread rape in the region. A former Janjaweed commander, Hemeti, he's now considered the most powerful man in Sudan's capital. Government leaders from Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates appear to be aiding the Sudanese military directly through money and weapons. In May, Hemeti met Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in Rudaya. There's another article that I'm not going to have time to get to today, but it's about the Middle Eastern princes that are supporting Sudan and what they're getting out of it. So stay tuned for that. I'll try to touch on that next week. But I mean, like, who guessed it? Saudi Crown Prince MBS, not a good guy. And they're in it for their own selfish reasons. So I mentioned this before, but the government in Sudan cut off internet access in the country, making it difficult for protesters to communicate with each other, as well as relay what's happening in Sudan to the outside world. The U.S. State Department issued a statement last week condemning the violence and calling for a, quote, civilian-led transition that leads to timely elections and free expression of the will of the Sudanese people. I mean, like, that's a very nice quote by the U.S. government, but it doesn't mean anything when you don't actually help. And as I said, the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Tibor Nagy, America's top diplomat for the country, or for the continent of Africa, rather, is scheduled to go to Sudan this week, as well as its neighbor Ethiopia, to try to make and broker a deal to end the violence. But as CBS notes, with the might of the Saudis and Emirates behind them, there is little reason to believe Sudan's military generals will back down. Again, MBS and Trump are like BFFs, so I don't see him going against him for that reason. So after all of this awfulness, how can you help? It's easy to feel helpless. I totally understand that. I feel all the time because we're over here, they're over there, and how can I actually help? But given the ongoing internet outages and other communication interventions in the region, figuring out how to help those in need the most can be difficult. But there have been pushes from those in other nations to get the word out about the food and about the need for food and supplies, as well as the growing concern over the violence's effect on the children. So first things first, you can post about it. You can tell, you can share what's going on, because a lot of news outlets aren't doing that themselves. In a statement on last Tuesday, UNICEF Executive Director Henrietta Fore said the team was, quote, gravely concerned with the impact of the unrest on the country's young people, especially the reported use of excessive force against peaceful protesters. UNICEF focuses its work on helping disadvantaged children across the globe, and it offers a variety of ways for those interested to help in their efforts to become involved in Sudan. So I would strongly encourage you going to UNICEF and seeing what they're doing and the petitions they have going on. There's a GoFundMe set up to aid with food and water and support for the Sudanese people. And there's also a petition calling for a UN investigation into the massive violence against protesters that's happened earlier in June, including a change.org petition that's likely to meet its goal of 75,000 signatures any moment now. So things are happening and not all is lost, even though it certainly feels like that. But if you are on the social medias and you're noticing maybe some people you're following or other people are turning their Twitter or Instagram user or profiles blue, I've been seeing this a lot, at least on my social media. Basically, this is because Mohammed Hashim Matar, he was just 26 when he was gunned down by Sudanese security forces last week. His favorite shade of indigo blue has become a symbol of the country Sudan's embattled pro-democracy uprising. Thousands of social media users have switched their Instagram and Twitter avatars to the same color, including the hashtag blue for Sudan. Amal Amir, who is a British Sudanese social media user who has taken part in the protest, she said that it started off with the friends and the family. It was his favorite color, and it was his display picture on all social media accounts. Then it started being for all martyrs. So I hope that was a good rundown of what's going on in Sudan. There's so much more, and I'll try to touch on next week the the Middle Eastern princes that are what's in it for them. You know, there's an opinion piece on the New York Times that talks about the princes who want to destroy any hope for Arab democracy, especially why Saudi Arabia and the UAE are backing military leaders who kill demonstrators, particularly the ones in Sudan, because both of these countries are backing the Sudanese military. But Saudi Arabia and the UAE have used their considerable resources to promote authoritarian governments run by military strongmen since the Arab Spring started in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't want anything. Yeah, you have to question why that is, and realize that they want to stay in power in any way they can. But both of these countries, they helped crush Bahrain's uprising. They bankrolled a return to military dictatorship in Egypt. They armed a rogue military leader in Libya and mismanaged a democratic transition in Yemen before launching a destructive war there, as Anna mentioned earlier. Saudi Arabia has been destroying Yemen, and the UAE is also there aiding the same thing. So,
yeah, at this point, UAE and Saudi Arabia are one and the same.
Yeah, it's just disgusting. And
they're evil regimes who want to maintain regimes all over the world, because the second you start taking down a different regime, you know, if you start taking out other people's regimes, it's going to become clear that their regime is just as evil and needs to go down as
well. Yeah, exactly.
So they don't want that sort of, they want to like destabilize other countries while not destabilizing their country. Mm-hmm. It's really weird. It's like you want to keep certain people in charge while at the same time completely destroying other countries.
Yeah.
It's not how it works.
It's just, and I'm sure my parents feel the same way, but I would love to live in a time when, like, Arab nations were united. But it just seems so far away, especially when these two huge leaders are destroying us. And honestly, especially with the Sudanese massacres that are going on, the massacre that I'm talking about happened on, I keep saying last week, it happened on June 3rd. When the Sudanese armed forces attacked sit-in protesters in their capital of Khartoum, killing more than 1,000 people and injuring over 500. And this included the rapes and everything, and disfigured bodies of protesters being pulled out of the Nile and protesters being burned in their sit-in tents, bloodied protesters being carried away to their makeshift first aid stations. This is a ghastly new chapter in the Saudi and the UAE counter-revolution against democratic movements in the Arab region, and it's unfolding in Sudan, whose generals have unleashed this terrible violence on supporters of democracy. So I think I'm going to talk more in depth about the leaders of Saudi Arabia and the UAE, in particular their support for Sudan and what it means and how they've been doing this the whole time, because I think especially with the media blackout, it's hard to visualize what's going on over there and see pictures, but it's awful. Like, you don't want to see disfigured bodies being pulled out of the Nile anyway. Just believe me that it's happening. And also, would that even make a difference? So, I don't know. Check out the links in our bio. Not on Instagram. Check out the links in our footnotes and our summaries and stuff, but what's going on over there deserves far more than just the amount of time I talked about it, but I'll talk about it more as we learn more. And if you have any Sudanese friends or anyone that you know from over there, just like give them your support, because it's really awful what's going on over there. And and also, I mean, going back to my mom and El Sarut, who died in Syria, like, it just feels so, this week was so hard for me to even decide what to talk about today, because either one was hopeless, like talking about the end of the Syrian revolution via this 27-year-old soccer player or the massacres in Sudan. So I understand this podcast isn't always happy, but it's necessary. So I hope that made sense and was worth your time. I'm sad, is my point.
No, we are always sad. Yeah.
I think that was a cohesive amount of information.
Well, Sudan has always been, there's like certain areas that like you just, there's like, it's always being like controlled by some evil entity.
Well, that's what happens when you have a military coup after military coup after military coup. Like, it's going to be unrest.
There's no stabilization. Like, there's no way to stabilize. And that's the unfortunate thing is, like, most of these elections are rigged for the most part.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing you can do.
It's just disheartening when you have so much civil unrest and the people are just, they're just, I don't know, so desperate to be free. And
that's why we should accept more immigrants. Oh my God, what a crazy idea. Wow. Like, let these people in our country because their fucking countries are killing them. Yep. Like, how insane is that? Like, if you're being burned alive because you're protesting by sitting on the ground.
That's exactly what happened. They burned their tents.
Yeah, like, that's a good enough reason to be like, maybe these people shouldn't live there.
Yeah.
If their own goddamn government don't want them alive because they're pointing out the fact that things are fucked up.
Give the government nothing to rule. Get the people out of there. I don't know. Anyways.
Or take that government down and put in a real government. Not that that's possible. You know, it's a weird thing because it's like, you always like, why can't America do anything? But at the same time, you don't want America in there like running shit. It's like this never ending catch 22 of like, there's nothing you can do unless the goddamn country decides to kind of step up. Not like the people, but I mean like the actual, like within the government, you need people to like dissent.
Yeah.
And that's like, you need enough people to dissent that they have them. Like, it's almost like this impossible feat. You need enough people to dissent that you can basically create an uprising within the government, like the people working in the government, like say like a like Congress all of a sudden being like, no more.
Yeah.
And like be risking their own lives to like say no to this like regime. Like, you need enough people to dissent in order for it to like start to collapse in on itself. Kind of like what's happening with Netanyahu. Like, he couldn't get a government together after this election. And things are slowly kind of collapsing in on themselves. Like, you need that. You need more, or like, you need that lack of structure to slowly destroy it from the inside. But that's, you know, I mean, very rarely do we have people brave enough to put their own lives at risk to bring down a government from the inside. It's not really that common of a thing. Oh, I mean, it kind of happens in the Trump administration when you have all these leaks because all these people are just being like, can you fucking believe that?
Yeah. It's disgusting.
I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't know. Do you know?
No, sounds like you don't know. I don't know shit.
I do want to emphasize another report came out that there is absolutely no evidence that Iran went after those goddamn oil tankers.
Yeah.
I was looking it up just to confirm if anything had come up since I said it. And even more came out that they have released no evidence and there apparently is just nothing coming out. There's just facts that the Trump administration is making up in their own minds to be like, guess what? This happened.
It's all a fucking sham. Don't believe anything.
We unfortunately have to record another episode after this, so we gotta run, y'all. Sorry.
We gotta run. But we did record an episode with Creature Feature that came out last week. If you guys haven't heard it, we talked with Katie Golden of Creature Feature about shapeshifters and animals that have really cool before and afters, so
they
check
transform.
It out. Yeah, it's really wild.
Also, something interesting that we're doing, we don't know what we're doing yet, but this Friday, it's June 21st, this Friday in Los Angeles at 9 p.m. at the PAC Theater, which is on 6470 Santa Monica Boulevard in Los Angeles, California. Friday, June 21st, 9 p.m., we are doing the show Podcast Party, where we do 15 minutes of our podcast. I don't know what we're going to do. It's interesting.
But it's going to be really fun. We're going to be there with Jamie and Caitlin from Bechdelcast.
Yeah.
And other really fun peeps. And if you want to come meet us, come out.
Pay what you can. So you can just show up and give as much money or whatever that you have. So PAC Theater, Friday night, June 21st, 9 p.m. Come hang out.
Yeah. We'll probably post about it on our Instagram, so you have all the details on there, too. But we'd love to see you. Come on out. Come meet us. Take some photos. Have some fun.
And there's a gin and juice sponsor, GR Dinera. I don't know if you guys are all into gin and juice. Pretty random, but
that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
I hope you guys come out, and I hope you guys that are in LA, I'll see you there.
And I've been getting more Sephora facials, so if you're ever at Sephora and want to get a facial with me, let me know.
Oh, wow. That's very...
I'm out here getting facials left and right.
Anyway, should we tell them where they can find us?
Yes, you can find us at Ethnically Am Big on IG. That's Instagram. Ethnically Am Amp on Twit. That's Twitter. And ethnicallyambiguouspod.com. That's our website.
Oh my god.
And I'm on Twitter at Ethnically Ambiguous. Oh no, wait. Oh Jesus. I'm on Twitter. I just literally short-circuited. I'm on Twitter at Anna Hosni.
And I'm on Twitter at Shirohero666, Shirohero, and then Instagram is just Shirohero. And really hope anyone that's in LA can make it out to the podcast party, Pack Theater, 9 p.m. Friday.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have to poo.
Okay.
That's so sad.
We should go.
Have you watched Chernobyl?
Yeah, I have.
It's going to be like that. So, all right, guys. Have a good one in Trina. Are you going to bite that ass?
I bite that ass.